This is Why We Write, a podcast of Lesley University. Each week we bring you conversations with authors from the Lesley community to talk about books, writing, and the writing life.
I'm Jana Vanderveer, Program Coordinator of the International Higher Education Program at Lesley. And I also graduated from and worked for Lesley's MFA program in creative writing for many years, where I met with our guest for today, who is Janet Pokoroba, who is the Associate Director of Lesley's MFA program, and she's also an alum of the program, and the author of The Fourth String, a memoir of her experience studying shamisen, a traditional Japanese instrument, under a Japanese teacher in Japan. We'll come back to exactly what that instrument is in a few minutes, but first I wanted to talk a little bit more about your experience in general to kind of, you know, set the scene for the conversation today.
Sure.
So welcome.
Hi, Jana.
Hi.
Good to see you again.
Yes. So first of all, what drew you or made you decide to go to Japan in particular? I know this was back in the 90s when a lot of people, a lot of Americans were teaching English in Japan in the 80s and 90s. But what made you choose Japan?
Okay. So this is going to sound really crass. The reason I chose to go to Japan is money.
Which money's is good.
Just to say, you're right. I did have a friend who went on the JET program, I think, that was really popular at the time, where you go and get set up in a town and teach for a couple of years. And when she went, I was like, oh, all right, whatever, like Japan? I really didn't know anything about the culture. Never wanted to go there. And so she went. I said, bye. Went on my way. I got a master's degree and then thought I was going to get a PhD and just live this quiet academic life. And then two things happened. I was getting a little bored with life. I was in my mid to late 20s. I'm like, I need some adventure before I settle down. So I was like, let me, you know, think about travel, because I had kind of a secret desire to travel in the world. And then I had some student debt by that point.
Uh-huh.
And my friend said, you know, Japan's not a bad place. You can make money. It was the end of the bubble, so it wasn't quite as big a bubble as it was. But she said, there's still a lot of lucrative jobs. And she kind of lured me there.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I got there. Yep. And I had a contract to teach 9 months, and I stayed 4 years.
Wow. That happens sometimes, you know,
yep.
So well, clearly it was beginning to study the shamisen that kind of made you decide to stay longer. So so I guess, you know, now is a good time to sort of say, how did you get started studying the shamisen, and kind of if you could explain a little bit about what it is to listeners who might not know.
Yeah, because it still remains pretty exotic. Although I have to say, when I went to Japan in the mid-late 90s, Japan was even lesser known. I feel like anime and graphic novel have really spiked in the past 20 years, as well as there's some shamisen duos, the Yoshida brothers who play shamisen. And so there are some more international things that I think people can latch onto. But at the time, I went, I was studying, I was there teaching. And my friend, who was this friend who said, please come, found this tiny little ad in a classified magazine, an English magazine, and it said, you know, free lessons in shamisen and singing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what the heck a shamisen was, but, you know, she knew I was musical. She's like, maybe this is something to just get you into Japan. I thought, okay. And so I went, and what I discovered was that the shamisen was sort of a strange thing. It was kind of like a banjo. I think that's the closest analogy I can come. Mm-hmm. It has three strings. It has a very long, skinny neck. And then it has this sort of square sound box that's covered with skin.
Mm.
Actually, cat skin or dog skin.
Mm.
Which took some getting used to. And it has quite a large plectrum. So it's the string, but it's also a bit percussive.
Uh-huh.
So it has a couple of different roles, and it's an instrument that's played in a variety of ways, but the way my teacher played it was as music for theater, so for the kabuki theater from the 18th century.
Mm.
So we're talking about a very old form that right. basically was still in place and being played the same way as back then.
So you returned from Japan eventually, and you tell this in this book, you tell the story of those 4 years and your relationship specifically with this teacher who you refer to as sensei,
yes.
which is the term for teacher in Japan, but she was very much against using that term.
I know.
Yeah,
I should probably just say too, just for people who will look at the book, it's the shamisen itself was surprising, but more surprising than that was the teacher. And I had expected, quite honestly, maybe a little old lady in a kimono. And she showed up, well, she was actually that day put in a kimono, but she was very non-traditional. She talks about herself in, you know, using Western address, using her first name. She didn't want to be called teacher. She wanted to be called by her first name. And she wore, you know, just regular clothes, just very, she really had a Western spirit, I would say, that she was applying to Japanese knowledge and Japanese tradition. You know, whereas I think just historically Japan, after the West came, they did a lot of applying of Japanese spirit to Western knowledge. But she was really like taking a whole new approach to this tradition that was so cloaked in mystery and money and patriarchy and all of the stuff that was making it so inaccessible to people. So she like battled this, you know, hundreds of years old system, you know, and it was so admirable. She just wanted to bring music to a place of pleasure. And, you know, it was her passion.
Right.
She's like, it shouldn't be about, you know, who you are and who you know.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, I think the other interesting thing that struck me was that she pretty much exclusively taught foreigners.
Exactly.
She was not a teacher to Japanese students. In fact, she shied away from that pretty strictly. So that's another very unusual thing, that she was taking this art form that is so Japanese and deliberately. And you mentioned in the book that, you know, there was some frustration, like, why aren't you teaching more Japanese people? Because they're the ones who will continue this tradition. The foreigners that come here will learn it for a while and then go back home, most likely. So,
yeah,
very interesting choice.
Exactly. And one of the paradoxes that's never resolved. I mean, she's a puzzle in a way, as am I. I think, you know, I'm trying to suss out in the book, you know, from 20 years later, you know, really, who was she to me? And, you know, who was I? And what was our relationship about? But there were so many things I didn't understand, you know, and those were just accepted in the end, or just embraced as part of the mystery. But she loved foreigners because of their passion, and they could be very direct about it, and expressive. You know, if we were playing with any expression in Japan, that would be a criticism. You were really supposed to play like you were kind of dead, just no expression. Very different. You know?
It's very, very, the whole musical realm is very different in Japan. So, but so how long did it take you to begin to work on this as a memoir after you came back to the U.S.? I mean, did it take a while to kind of process the experience, or, you know, what made you decide to write this story?
That's a great question. When I came back after several years, I think it was 2001, I think I was so in shock and just kind of grief-stricken at having left and confused, because I think there was always a part of me that was like, should I have stayed? I left my teacher. Should I have stayed? But I had a new life. I was trying to embrace my future. I wanted to be home. So I think the first writings were out of a need to just put everything down, because I was terrified I'd forget. And the other piece, just to say, like, when I went to Japan in the mid-90s, imagine this now. No internet that we were using. I had no laptop, no cell phone, no GPS, no YouTube. I couldn't Google the shamisen. I couldn't Google a video to even see what it sounded like. I remember after I started, after my first lesson with her, I was so attracted to this music and so like curious, and I immediately went looking for a book, because that's how I learn things. Find a book. And I went to the bookstore, and the one book was out of print. You know, and so I had to rely on her exclusively. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it would have been a different journey had I gone there today. Because right. I think one of the things about the story is that, and I think being in Japan, and you have been in Japan, mm-hmm. How do you get used to not knowing? Mm. How do you experience this not knowing part of the culture that they very much embrace?
Right.
Right?
Right.
So I feel in a way like the story starts, I know nothing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it ends where I know nothing. But mm-hmm. I know that I know nothing at the end.
Right.
You know?
The more informed nothing.
Totally. So, you know, when I came back, it was like, oh, get it all down. But it was so close still. Mm, there was no right. story there or shape. You know? It was just a lot of emotion. But I was writing and I sent it out. And I did get the interest of an agent. And I thought, everything's ready. Okay. My life is made. And that was like the beginning of just like a 15-year process.
Right.
And so, you know, I eventually ended up going to Breadloaf, the Breadloaf Writers Conferences, mm-hmm. to work on the book with a mentor there, Vivian Gornick, who mm-hmm. was one of my favorite writers. And she just tore it to pieces. She was just like, who are you? Why are you writing this? Like, you need a story.
Right.
And I was like, really? It's not just, it happened?
Right, right.
So it took many years to go from just what happened to process. That's when I processed, Jen.
Right.
It was later. And then it took a long time.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I had to peel away some layers of Japanese-ness in a way. And one of those layers for many years was this ultimate obedience and respect for my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go from writing it for her
right.
to writing it just for me, including right. my story. And as you know now, it's like a biography and a memoir. So it's really like right. two women's stories.
Yeah.
Because we're both important, I think. But, you know, really, in the end, I think it felt somewhat transgressive to write my story because right. I had to kind of just say, I'm important.
Right.
And it's not about you.
Right.
And that was scary,
right.
So, you know?
Yeah, and has she read the book? Or I know you've talked with her about it, but how much does she actually know it?
I know. I just sent it to her. Before the book was published last year, I went right to her in Tokyo, and we spent a couple of weeks. And I read a lot of it aloud to her, and I read parts that were questionable. Anything, she had her son-in-law read it, you know, relatives. So anything that was suspect or, you know, and there were things that she pointed out that I thought were totally benign. But to her, it was a certain thing. So I said, okay, let's redo that. And then things that I thought she was really not going to like, she was like, oh, leave it in. So it was really just another, and it really deepened our relationship.
Yeah.
And I feel like it really brought me a little more into a little more equal.
Right.
Relationship now because, you know, she has her art, I have my art now, and you know,
right.
I'm not only her disciple.
Yeah.
So it was very transformative, but I was really terrified. And as soon as the book was taken, I had many nightmares where I thought, oh my God, she's going to say you can't publish this.
Right.
And like, I'll have to novelize it or something. You know, I didn't know what to do. I was
you
like,
you can't publish it or I'll cut you off
yes.
or whatever. Yeah.
That's exactly.
That's a scary part about memoir, I think.
In one passage of the book, so I was talking about suicide. And I was talking about this passage where she was very down and feeling suicidal, which she had told me this story. And so I included that. And, you know, suicide in Japan is not unknown. And I was like, you know, who else hasn't had these thoughts, of course. But then I said something about, like, you know, I didn't know she was depressed. And so when we talked, she was like, she really objected to the word depressed, which I found interesting because I thought suicide might be more relevant.
Right,
but
right.
I think, too, just the state of like mental illness in Japan or any kind of thing like that is maybe still not okay to talk about. So she really was like, oh, depressed. So I said something instead like, you know, I didn't know her mood.
Right.
She wanted her name out. You know, so that's why I would call her sensei.
Okay.
But yeah, so she surprised me sometimes.
So, yeah, so you can you talk a little bit more about how the process ended up being of over this 15-year process of writing the book? I know you eventually came to the MFA program you know, began to work with mentors there, but you had work to do even after that to finish shaping it. And
that's a great point. Yeah, even if you go to a program or to school, you hope to get the tools to build the book. Doesn't mean you have the book. I thought I had the book. I had the agent at that time still. But, you know, we'd gotten a lot of feedback from publishers saying, what's it about? You know, I love the writing, but what's it about? You know, so really, I think for memoir writers, drilling down on that is really hard, and it can take many drafts because we kind of think we've covered it, but we've often left ourselves out of it, or we're leaving out something. So when we hear that, what's it about? What's it about? I tend to think it means that a point of view is missing. And I think even in a memoir, there's a point of view, right? It's you, a former you, a you, but we have to somehow shape the events for the reader, you know? Now, some memoirs are out there and they're published and they're great, and they don't do that a lot. They just kind of give you a lot of scenes and they show a lot of stuff. But I think the most compelling ones for me really tell the reader what this meant to them, right? You know, not just the experience, but what is this? So I spent, let's see, from 2006, after I graduated from the Leslie MFA program, I started working for the program. My agent disappeared, literally stopped taking my calls. I sent certified letters. I think because I wasn't selling to a big six publisher, he was like, well, I was horrified. I was so embarrassed. I think I just felt like, oh my God, he dumped me. I had been dumped. And I think for about 2 years, I didn't even try to publish anything. I was very sensitive about it. I was like, oh, what do I do? And so I just sort of tried this and that. I would sometimes get into writing groups, but it was always kind of the same thing. What's it about? I think I was still in the middle of the experience. You know, still going back to Japan every year to perform for my teacher. I hadn't ended things yet. And I think you can't write about something until it's ended. And I didn't want it to end. This one was like, ah! So it really, it wasn't until, you know, several years after that where I started to really say, well, I have to focus on my life and this book and creating what I want it to be. But that was a big... It's a big leap because it can feel like a betrayal almost to life. You're almost betraying life. You're making a story now. And all the people in it, you're kind of feeling like, okay, sorry, you're now part of my cast of characters. You know, it can feel a little funny. So you have to kind of just let that go and just go into your own space and deal with that later. You know, when I teach, we tell the students that too. Just write it. Don't worry about mom. You know, it's always mom, you know, or teacher. You know, worry about it later. But try to get to the real story. What's this about? I was just reading some student work for my class this afternoon. And I, same thing. I was like, there's no intimacy here. I'm not seeing yet. What is this experience to you? So going to that core, I just feel like it takes years of like scraping through layers of defense and you know, what you think it should be, what you want it to be, what the world wants it to be,
the persona that you think you have to kind of have out there, which, you know, in fiction you can sort of have that distance, but in memoir, for it to really work effectively, you can't. You have to kind of put it all out on the page, which is a scary thing. Very scary.
It really is. Even if, and you've read the book, so you see that it's written in a somewhat stylized fashion. You know, even this manuscript, certain agents, when I first sent it out, were like, "Well, we want more of you on the page." Like, they wanted me to, like, spill my guts. And I was like, there's a Japanese quality to this book. It's like the Japanese me. And I was like, this is not a spill your guts book. Sorry. I want to reveal everything or not everything, because that's more Japanese to leave some mystery. And I wanted to reveal things, but in a slower way, not just, and not obviously like, let me just say blah, 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 blah. You know, it was like, I wanted to have, most importantly, things revealed in relationship. And that was the biggest thing for me, like, because I didn't know for the longest time, whose story is it? I was like, okay, is it my story? And I kept thinking, no, it's about my teacher. Is it my story? Is it my teacher? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I met Gish Jen, who came to Leslie mm-hmm. to do a presentation. And I asked her, I just said, Gish, this is what I'm hearing from people. Whose story is it? What should I do?
Right.
And she had just given a lecture on non-Western narratives. Mm-hmm. Tiger Writing had come out. Mm-hmm. Girl with the Baggage Claim. It was all that material. And she said, well, of course, it's both of you.
Mm.
And she totally gave me permission to do it in this right. way. I didn't have to have some single heroic journey.
Right.
I'm independent. No, the book, if anything, is about how we're all interdependent.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And nothing ends. And there is no closure.
That really struck me in reading it, is how it is very interdependent, which is a very sort of, you know, Eastern style of relationship and engagement.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and it's scary. I think it's scarier than being independent, because mm-hmm. you really realize, oh, I do rely on this person for this, or mm-hmm. this person is part of me. And because I was sort of embarrassed by the dependence, you know, like we're American, we're not dependent on things like
right.
that. So I just would feel like this person has such power over me and is so important. And I'm sort of embarrassed by that, you know, like I feel like I should be sort of more strong or more independent or free or something like that. So there was a lot of that kind of thinking, and it took a long time to even be able to see the experience and see Japan. I was so in it. I remember coming back and just feeling like, where are all the people? And like in Japan, you have all these connections with people, and you're really tied to people in a way that's very special. And I came back to America. I was like, well, who? I just felt so alone.
Right.
It was like really sad
for
a while.
Yeah.
I couldn't listen to music. I was like, oh my God. So I think I had to come out of what I'd gone into.
Right.
Which was tough.
Yeah.
And that's then
the classic re-entry piece, right? But it's one that is so subtle, it can be very difficult to recognize as being that sudden sense of isolation.
Exactly.
When you're used to this interweb of community and connection, which can be its own burden sometimes, but then also, you are part of it.
I know.
So I know you write in the book too about, you know, other relationships that you have while you're there with other students and with other teachers of other art forms as well.
Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, my questions around that are, did any of those people who are in the book know that they're in the book? Did you have to kind of negotiate anything with them? And sort of, you know, how did those relationships turn out? Are you still in relationship with any of them in terms of?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there's a lot of people involved.
Yeah,
right?
It's not just you and Sensei. There's, as you said, this web of people that all contribute to the story.
But there is one character who, if people read the book, there's quite a drama around with my teacher, and it ends somewhat badly for her. Mm-hmm. And and it was someone who played music with us, and so I had this close relationship with, and then I suddenly just had no relationship with, and I really sort of cut off ties. And so it was, and I had not spoken to him in 20 years.
Mm.
So when the book was taken, I thought, I have to talk to him. Mm. I have to find out if it's okay, because this is a pretty dramatic light that I'm showing him in, and I really need his blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Not permission. I felt like, you know, this is my story, but I also was humble. Like if someone wanted something changed, I was going to say fine. Like I wasn't going to be like, hey, it's my art. But I wrote to him.
Mm.
And I sent the book in a big PDF and, you know, just said, hello, hello. And this is happening. And please read and let me know. And I was on tenterhooks. I was terrified. He didn't write back for like a couple weeks.
Mm.
And I didn't know what to expect. And one day there was his email and I opened it up, and he gave me his full blessing. But he said it when he saw my message, it took him about 2 or 3 days to recover.
Mm.
There was so much emotion. And I think I had that too on my end, because we just stopped our relationship. So even seeing and even communicating with him was like bringing back that time, which was so laden with emotion. And so he said, no, this is your story. I may tell mine differently, but this is yours, and it's fine. And so I thanked him deeply, filed that away from my lawyers. My publisher was like, just put those in a file. And then, but there's some people in there that don't know they're in there. And I didn't feel like I had to notify them. I asked my publisher. He's like, no.
Mm.
So You can't talk to everybody, I guess.
Yeah.
And as long as it's clear that it's your point of view.
Right.
You know, it's as long as it's not a libelous kind of thing.
Right.
You know, everyone has their own memories, right? And
exactly.
As we know, everyone remembers differently. So.
Right.
So memoir is risky.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
But, you know, the other thing that kind of struck me about the book is, you know, so much of it is about communication. You know, communication, not just, you know, there's the Japanese and English part, you know, where you are always either struggling in Japanese or someone is trying to communicate with you in non-native English, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's the concept of communication through music, right? That music is, for those of you who are playing these instruments, somewhat of a universal mm-hmm. language, but then there's the whole concept of trying to communicate the teaching and the learning of those instruments in a way that is very different from traditional Western style teaching and communication of information. So.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's on so many levels. And I have to say, I think the closest level is the music.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a quote I have in the book. I think I say that they say that music, people who are musical together feel closer than people even of the same culture.
Right.
You know, and I think there is something when you're playing music with people,
mm-hmm.
It is sort of a oneness. You're entering that oceanic kind of feeling because you're in something together completely, and it's nonverbal.
Right.
So it's more of the soul or of the heart or the spirit or something. And it's got this really powerful effect, I have found.
Mm.
And I think I always knew that because I always loved music and played music. And, to that end, like it would be confusing to me almost because I would want to like express and articulate my feelings for my teacher or something, but she was always like in the music, you know, and the two are like this in Japan, they're linked. It's the,
right.
It's who is my character and how do I play music? They say, don't try to separate us.
Mm.
But I always did. So I would say to her, she would always say, well, if we didn't have music and if I wasn't creating all these performances, you'd have no reason to come back to Japan. And I would say, well, what are you talking about? Like, I would come back to see you. And she'd be like, well, of course, no meaning.
Mm.
And I would almost be, I was so mad when she said that. I didn't even know why I was mad, but I was like, well, of course, you know. And like, it wasn't until many years later that I kind of realized that we do exist in music.
Mm.
That really is our relationship. And who we are and how we play is the same. And anything we're going to resolve in our relationship is going to be through music.
Mm.
Our love for each other, our frustrations for each other,
right.
It's never going to be separate.
Right.
And maybe that's a Western thing too. Like I kept trying to separate things.
Yeah.
Whereas they were okay. Just having it be more amorphous.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me itchy. I was like, no, like, get it apart. Like, I need to kind of have things in a box.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And it was so much feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was hard. It was hard to not. I always want to put feelings into words because then I can control it and kind of master it.
Right.
But a lot of times with her, it was just, no, keeping it to be this big, you know, mystery.
Right.
And I was like, it's not my way.
You know, how difficult was it to kind of find English words to talk about all of these concepts and these things that kind of happen very, you know, beneath the surface in Japan? Because that's a writerly challenge as well.
Oh, my God. You hit on it. That was another reason why it took me 15 years. I think I say in the book, infection without understanding.
Mm.
Right? And that really is sort of the teaching style. So Ma is a very big concept. It's the first thing you learn. And, you know, it's really basically space or silence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's silence between the notes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always looking at the note. To me, it was like, well, that's the note. That's the melody. And she was constantly stopping me.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't pause correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't in the absence.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what?
Right.
So even that was like a mind blower. But in some ways, and again, because of my absolute naivete of anything Japanese, and because of the lack of all the media back then, I don't know, maybe I'm over-exaggerating that, but it seems like I was sort of at her command.
Right.
So all I had to do was imitate her,
right?
That was the model of education. Just imitate. Just do it, do it, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask any questions.
Mm.
So fine to live there. But as you point out, when I came back and had to then describe these things, I was at a loss.
Mm.
I had to get it out of my system first and then say, well, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
And then once it's out and you define it, what is it in the story?
Mm-hmm.
And as I wrote each draft, it became clear which concepts were going to be metaphoric. Mm-hmm. So then you start making the story, right?
Right, right.
And then the Ma, I thought, space, that's a little bit of a metaphor.
Yeah.
Of the distances between us. It's mm-hmm. even a little bit how I structured the book. Because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of space. I do a lot of segmentation and little sections.
Right.
So I do kind of pause a lot,
yeah.
which I realized kind of later. So I think the pausing was big, the absence and the silence.
Right.
You know, as a balance. Right.
Well, like I teach my intercultural communication students, you know, silence is as much a form of communication as speech is or sound. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And it's the other thing about silence, I find, because it's not defined, it's more connecting.
Mm.
I find it's very connecting kind of quality. Mm. Once you have words, we're separate.
Right.
And we can start calling things by name.
Mm-hmm.
But when you don't have that, you know, you can be in it together in this amorphous right. kind of womb-like way. And mm-hmm. it felt like that, you
yeah.
know, which is wonderful in many ways. But then at one point in my journey, I was terrified. I was like, wait a minute. I don't understand anything that's going on.
Mm.
Right. And I was like, how am I going to ever leave here?
Yeah.
And, you know, those hard decisions now of like, well, I got to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I am always going to be a white woman
mm-hmm.
in this culture. I'm always going to be the white girl in the kimono. I'm always going to mm-hmm. be treated as a stranger.
Right.
I'm never going to get the satisfying intimate relationships that I ultimately crave.
Right.
And so I was turning towards home, but then it was like, oh my, that's when my Western mind kind of came back and I was like, how to even begin to explain or understand for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think really that the book is the journey to understand.
Right.
I think that finally was the moment where I was putting on the page, all right, showdown, like what mm-hmm. did this mean? And so you have that voice of 20 years on
right.
looking back.
Right.
Because it was just a big journey, and it's still going on.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't end.
Yes.
Yeah. Closure. That's another myth.
Yeah.
I think, right?
Well, because even the title of the book, The Fourth String, it refers to, you're mentioning the shamisen has three strings, but the fourth string is that relationship between
yes.
teacher and student
yes.
that continues on well past the book. It's not like, as you said, you've gone home and now you never see her again. You know, you still see her, you still perform.
Exactly, so. Exactly. And a lot of narratives that I had read about people that had gone to Japan to study something did treat it as a discrete adventure,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, they studied something and then they came home
mm-hmm.
and they wrote about it in that way. And maybe that was their experience. I don't know. But
mm.
I would read these stories and just crave a deeper understanding. I said, well, did you not come home confused?
Right.
Did you not come home like sad? Did you not come home like
right.
wondering about all these things? So
mm-hmm.
I didn't want a neat and clean narrative that mm. it just didn't feel true to me, like without those sort of messy parts
yeah.
and those back and forth, a lot of questions in this text, I think
right.
a lot of like, you know,
yeah.
what did this mean? And what is culture? Like the sort
right.
of thing that I would, so
yeah.
I think, and again, as a memoirist and as a, the craft of writing, I think it's easy to fall into this trap of like, I know everything or
mm-hmm.
I know this. And I had to get into like, I don't know. Like, and you
mm-hmm.
can include that in a memoir.
Yeah.
I don't know this. I doubt,
right.
I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And all these great things. Like they're part of the story too, and they're very human.
Right.
And I hope they draw the reader in, because I hope, you know, everyone has doubts about
right.
what their own perception of reality
right.
is. So
right. Well, I mean, I think you definitely, you know, did that. And I think you were able to sort of get underneath the skin of Japanese culture in a way that a lot of memoirists, you know, who have experienced other cultures don't. You know, I find in a lot of books there's this tendency to exoticize or otherize people from other cultures. You know, oh, aren't they quaint? Aren't they amusing? Isn't this strange or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And you are
mm-hmm.
always looking at it from a perspective of their perspectives are
mm-hmm.
this, you know, they're
mm-hmm.
just as valid as mine. And I'm struggling to understand what this means. And
yeah.
know, what these concepts mean, which are very different. And so I really kind of liked that about the book. I thought that you kind of really got under there in a very meaningful way that I think will, you know, for anybody who has ever been abroad or experienced another culture in a deeper way, they'll really kind of understand that.
I think I had to really wrestle. I also wanted the book, a lot of those narratives coming out of Japanese experiences or other things, you know, it's the learning culture, so it's about mastery. And I wanted to make it clear that I didn't master. So I wanted failure to be a part of it. So I was trying for this perfection. It had to be a perfect something. And no, it's like so much messier than that. And I think in Japan, another thing that was shocking to me, but which has become a touchstone value in my life is limitation is the path to freedom. You know, and it sounds like a koan, but a Zen, you know, parable or puzzle, because I thought freedom meant, well, I get to do whatever I want, like free. I'm free. Hello. Like, I'm just out there. But like one of the first things was like, no, she was cutting me, you know, into a shape to be put on the stage. And it was then within that shape that I started to really find some mastery over my own life. So even though I kind of failed the shamisen, I think I do learn something about life. And, and you know, it's, and freedom is not about you get to do whatever you want. It's about responsibility, limiting yourself in the way you want to be limited. But you have to have limitations. You know, I mean, I remember thinking about, like, I'd come back to visit. I'd come back to America and I'd go to the grocery store. And I'm in an aisle of cereal that has about like 500 boxes of cereal. And I would, my mind would be blown because I'd be in Japan and just these little tiny markets and there's not that much choice over
there's three.
And you don't even miss it. And you come back and you're like, well, we have all this choice in America. But then I would wonder, well, choices to what though? Do we care about cereal? Choices to our leaders, yes. We want to have some choices as to our rights. But then we get distracted with all this other choice. So, yeah. So those are mind eye-opening, very maturing things that happened over there.
So what do you kind of hope that readers will take away from this?
From this, from the book? Well, I think the book actually has a couple different audiences. And for people who know Japan, I hope that they take away just another different story about Japan. And and for general readers, I hope they touch into maybe a special time of learning in their own life, a special teacher, if they're musical, what that was like. You know, I hope they can enjoy the, like the push and pull and the tug and the angst of relationship, because I just feel like that's what it's all about. And so to not be afraid of other cultures, not be afraid of entering them, I think not appropriate, don't take someone's voice, but if you want to know, go ask questions, be there, absorb traditions and just get to know something different other than yourself.
So finally, what are you working on now? I mean, besides besides getting the book out there, are you doing other, what other projects are you working on?
I think I'm going to be the kind of writer who always has the next project because I can't bear the thought of being like without anything. So I had this other project started before I finished this one. And it's about this very small village that I live in Vermont, where there's a cooperative store, which is the oldest store in New England, and it's 80 years old, and it's this little ramshackle place run by women. So it's this little matriarchal culture that I'm sort of a part of up there, and so it's about, it's really about my coming to settle there as a single childless woman, just settling down. So I find relationships just fascinating.
So they definitely are.
So it's a Vermont story next time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me today, Janet.
Thanks, Jana.
Thank you for listening to Why We Write. For more information on Janet Pokorova and to see a photo of her playing the shamisen, head over to our podcast page, www.leslie.edu/podcast. And that link is in the show notes. Next week, you'll hear more from Janet as she interviews Fabiola Desius, a young playwright who is introducing Boston youth to her craft. Here's a clip.
if you want to write about single parent, because that's what you've grown up in, a single parent household, write about that. If you want to write about sports because you love basketball, write about that. Whatever is the thing that itches you, put that on paper and see what comes out.